Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of 2024 of About That H2L. And we're going to start off with a bang because we have once again on the podcast Michael Bonner, that's written in defense of civilization, how the past can renew the present, which we discussed the last time, which I highly recommend the episode. And this week we're going to do a little bit different than what we normally do, because we are going to discuss history, but we are going to discuss how history is used for propaganda, and especially how tyrants such as Adolf Hitler and Stalin or communist regimes or Putin today uses history for their own purposes and shape and justify history for the invasion of the Second World War, or how they justified their existence, or how Putin justified his invasion of Crimea or Ukraine today. So this is the topic I wanted to cover for a long time, and I think this is an important topic to cover as well. But the history, as we will see in a second, has always been trying to shape in people's own view and images, and ancient and historic. It's always existed, and we don't begin with ancient and medieval chroniclers and see how they use history to write. For example, in ancient times, if emperors such as Nero, Caligula were, you know, on the bad side of the Senate, they would go quite harshly, maybe too harshly sometimes, against these emperors. So let's talk about how medieval and ancient historians have, maybe in ancient times, how they as well have used history to use it for propaganda purposes, especially. And I think when the Flavians come to, it's a good point here, because when the Flavians came to the throne, they would use an anti-Julio-Claudian propaganda to justify their existence after a year for emperors. So I don't want to begin there, if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me, and thanks for having me back. I guess you could say that the, you know, seeking a kind of home for the present in the past is something that, you know, all human communities have tried to do, and tyrants and, you know, dictators and evil people are perhaps no exception. I guess it's a question more of how truthful and how successful that linkage really turns out to be. You know, in the case of the Romans, you have this sort of somewhat imaginative double lineage of tracing the first Romans back not only to the sort of Romulus and Remus myth, but also to Troy, and it's a somewhat sort of convoluted means by which those two are reconciled in the Aeneid, for instance. You know, I don't know to what extent people still debate this, but there once was a debate, I think, in the mid 20th century, the extent to which the settlement under the Emperor Augustus, you know, was that a break with the past, or did it represent sort of greater continuity? Was it a restoration of anything or not? Obviously, Augustus and company and his successors wanted to think, I think, more of more in the way of continuity and connection with the ancient Roman past. Augustus was very keen on reviving the old religion and so forth. But, you know, eventually that the old Roman religious and other practices get sort of diverted into the cult of the emperor and sort of propping up the state with an attempt to give it sort of ideological strength or support. And, you know, it's kind of questionable how successful that really was. And eventually, you know, Christianity took the took the place of that. And again, that's also, you know, to what extent does that represent continuity or break with the past? Obviously, I think a lot of people would, you know, people would have sort of come down on either side of that, depending on whether they liked it or not. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's certainly also a dark side to the idea of trying to link or trying to use the past to justify present abuses or injustices. But if you read the Roman historians, you know, Tacitus or, you know, practically everybody else too, there doesn't seem to be any doubt in their minds that there has been a break with Republican traditions of virtue and morality, and that the Principate represented a decline, no matter how much Augustus and company wanted to think otherwise.
And lineages as well is another thing that people always use. Royalties has always used to justify their, even if there has been a coup d'etat or something, they always justify, for example, in ancient Rome, Heliogabalus, the mad emperor, quote-unquote, he just claimed that he was traced from Caracalla, who was somewhat, though it doesn't make sense in any way, he still uses trace, and, oh, I'm somehow related, I don't remember how, but I'm somehow related to Caracalla, though he was from Syria, and there's kind of vast difference there, but still, as well in medieval times as well, and of the modern era, there has always been this justification that Caesar, for example, traced his lineage from, I don't remember the name of God, but he traced himself a lineage from the gods, the Roman gods, for example. So there's always this justification that you are higher nobility because you are descended from this or this historical person.
Yeah, and often, you know, sort of fake or imaginary genealogies, such as from gods or what have you, can be discovered or made up or what have you. There's also the famous sort of myth of you know, a child found without parents, sort of Moses or Sargon, or later Ardashir, founder of the Sasanian dynasty, which is also kind of like the Romulus and Remus story. Oedipus, the Oedipus story there, Cyrus the Great. Yeah, so there's definitely that. I mean, I think overwhelmingly the idea is to establish some kind of continuity with a previous dynasty or political order that was deemed to be legitimate. So you know, nobody wants to, you know, I have to say this sort of guardedly, practically nobody wants to be seen as a revolutionary, certainly not in the ancient world. And that, you know, there's often this myth of sort of restoring a golden age or a former time of prosperity or at least an age of legitimate government. And, you know, in the sort of late antique West or early medieval West, you know, you have a group of Germanic invaders sort of falling over one another, trying to maintain some semblance of continuity with the old Roman state, basically acting like Roman emperors in all but name. And of course, Charlemagne eventually is the sort of rehabilitator of this tradition after some period of abeyance. And, you know, his own kingdom didn't sort of last very long, but the idea that his European monarchy could somehow unite the Roman heritage with the Germanic, you know, that proved to be a very influential one, and that has continued to this day, the Holy Roman Empire was,
neither holy nor Roman.
Right. Around which Europe nevertheless sort of revolved for quite a long time. And then you have Napoleon, who famously dissolved the Holy Roman Empire, who nevertheless claimed to be sort of Charlemagne 2.0. So, it's all obviously an idea with has a great deal of inertia and seems to have a certain staying power to it. Even the modern European Union, they have a Charlemagne prize, and there's been some effort to I think the Charlemagne prize was given to the euro, to the euro currency in 2002, which seems kind of silly, but it happened nonetheless. It's kind of odd to think of a currency being the sort of heir to Charlemagne or something, but in any case, the idea of Charlemagne is a sort of first European in some kind of modern sense, which I think is somewhat exaggerated, but it's nevertheless an appealing idea that gives
and after that, if I may, after the break as well, for himself as the successor of Charlemagne, needs so called revive the Holy Roman Empire in his time.
Yeah.
But as well in Central Asia, and the Tamerlane in his time, they were so disimportant that we have to be either from Genghis Khan or Tamerlane and the first Mughal as well. One of his reasons why he got to power was because he, I don't remember his name, but his, and again, so this is why I'm not a historian. But that's he as well claimed that this is why this. From this new dynasty, that I am descendant of Tamerlane, so that's my justification for founding a new Mughal empire.
Yeah, and then of course the Mongols in Iran are not only the the descendants of Tamerlane and Genghis and the warriors of the steppe, but also they eventually get. Actually, well, not eventually, it's actually quite quickly, they get absorbed into Iranian traditions of kingship and monarchy, and sort of carrying on the torch passed by the Sasanians and their viziers and so forth. So yeah, everybody wants to be associated with some kind of touchstone of political legitimacy and seemingly of good government. It's kind of odd to think of these sort of, to think of these barbarians like Theodoric
I mean, I would say that barbarian might be a bit vague word in this case scenario, but yeah.
Yeah, sort of carrying on this sort of tradition of writing. Having poems written about him in Latin and all the rest of it, but the same kind of thing happens in the East too with the Mughal rulers of India or those of Iran, it's hard to imagine how any sort of ordinary person would have reacted to any of that at the time, but that's what they wanted.
Mm. And if I may go back to ancient times again, the Flavians, I believe they were masters as using history to justify their claim to the throne. Like, we are so much better than, as I mentioned, we are so much better than the Euclideans, and that their writing of history, I think, has almost up to the modern day, is what people's perception of the Euclidean dynasty has been, I think, that because of the Flavians' masterfully propaganda against the Euclideans, they are kind of, that's kind of been the perception of the of this dynasty up until modern era almost.
Yeah, so who are you thinking of? Like
Flavian, and how Josephus and all these historians in favor of Flavians, against the Euclideans, how this almost how people have viewed the Neo-Napoleon dynasty up until this day because of the writing in Flavian's time and in the Flavian dynasty.
Yes. Now, yeah, I guess it's kind of debatable to what extent anybody believed, say, I don't know, like the more extravagant claims of the Augustan history or, you know, Suetonius earlier. I think Tom Holland compared Suetonius on the Julio-Claudians to the New York Times on Trump. Like, to what extent was it? Because there's some pretty outrageous claims, but yeah, obviously that got written down and not the other stuff, so or not any other series of opinions. So, yeah, I mean, they were obviously, cast in a bad light by their successors who wanted to seem far more successful and, you know, more virtuous people. The same sort of thing happens in Chinese dynastic history. You know, there's often a kind of dim view of the previous, previous set of rulers. But, you know, Suetonius and company are pretty, set a pretty high standard in saying offensive and mean things about the Caesars.
And before we go into modern times, which is going to be our main discussion, but I feel like we have to introduce in order to understand that this is nothing new and that this has always been around. I wanted to talk about the Crusades for a little bit as well, because as you know, when Pope Urban II launched the Crusade as well, there is also a historic claim that Jerusalem have always belonged to the Christians. And no, it hasn't. Who do you think it belonged to before the Christians? It was the Romans and the Jews and were there before the Christians, but they claimed to justify the Crusades is that it always has been Christian hands, but it's obviously bollocks. But you know, that, and even though Jerusalem has been lost for 90 years up until this point, still uses this justification that we need to take back the Holy Land that always belonged to the Christian nations.
Yeah, I mean, the Crusades is one of the, or at least the first Crusade. It's one of the great sort of actually revolutionary moments in European history. And I mean, revolutionary in a negative sense that I invoke constantly throughout my book. I think I gave the Crusades only about a few sentences in there, which I probably shouldn't have done. But the idea that you can, you know, that something like warfare is a penitential act, is a bit new. It's not quite the same thing as a just war or a holy war, but that war is penitential seems quite weird. And as you say, this idea that sort of reimposing a kind of Christian warrior elite on a foreign place would sort of assist Christendom to salvation and so forth. You know, that was a new and revolutionary idea. And the idea, the justification that you mentioned is really quite bogus. I mean, when the Byzantine emperor invited the Pope to send a few mercenaries to help him out, this was not at all what he or anybody else had in mind. This is somewhat beyond my period of expertise, but I seem to think
I'm fairly certain that Pope Urban must have misread Turner on the cheek.
What's that?
I'm fairly certain that when Pope Urban launched the crusade against the infidels, that he must have misread the part where Jesus said, "Turn the other cheek."
Right, exactly. So you have, I seem to think that there's some relationship between the First Crusade and the spirit of the Gregorian reforms that sort of preceded in the early 11th century. I don't know enough about this to say for sure, but this, you know, Tom Holland has this idea of the reforms of Gregory as Pope Gregory as sort of remaking the entire world, rejigging Christendom in a fundamentally new way, which nevertheless is portrayed in many sources as a revival of some sort of older thing, which is not really what it was. But finding the justification for this in some sort of past precedent, I think is really quite imaginative and was really quite unsuccessful. I mean, the first crusade may have been a success in the sense that territory was captured and held, but it wasn't at all good for the Byzantine Empire in the long run, or ultimately for the future of future of Christians of any sort in the East.
So let's talk about another thing in just on the Islamic side, where you have the caliphate that supposedly it would be a caliph. Of course, this kind of changes over time, but in the caliphate, you have to, and there it goes back the lineage again, where you have to be descendants from Muhammad and the Prophet and you have to have Mecca and Medina in order to be proclaim yourself a caliphate. And it's the case in the first cases, but eventually, as we have seen, it's not really the case at all, that the title caliph kind of loosened up, and as we will see, the Ottomans have no relations whatsoever to Muhammad or his family, so their claim to caliphate as well is kind of loose. But there again, it comes to lineages that you need to justify why you call yourself the title of caliph as well.
Yeah, I mean, who is the rightful successor to Muhammad? You know, this is a question that's still a live question between Sunni and Shia Islam, and you know, the attempt to sort of gloss over, you know, there have been attempts to gloss over it in the past, notably the Abbasid revolution was meant to have sort of Shiite undertones, with this theory of, you know, the successor, the rightful caliph must be a satisfactory member of the Prophet's family. And, you know, technically the Abbasid family is, you know, that is a branch of Muhammad's family, but it wasn't, it certainly didn't have the direct lineage that the Shia preferred. But yeah, this is a question that has never really been fully or finally settled. In the case of modern Islam, or, you know, Islam after the destruction of Baghdad in 1258, you know, there was, as I understand it, a great deal of soul searching about the future of the very future of the religion itself without a caliph. And as you say, the Ottoman and the Egyptian Fatimid quote-unquote caliphates, you know, their claims were rather
loose.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe there's an extent to which the claim, however loose, is simply justified by popular popular acceptance. However, in the absence of either a claim or of popular acceptance, I think it was Ibn Taymiyyah who said, "No caliph, no Islam," which is obviously a problem if you believe that. But I mean, the religion has obviously continued in some respects. It continued even to flourish after the loss of the Abbasid caliphate. The Shiite theory of the hidden imam, for instance, is impervious to the sort of vicissitudes of history and politics, which may explain to some degree why Iranian political Islam has been comparatively more successful. But finding, you know, what this puts me in mind of is the, if you think of the question about, you may not have heard it, but you know, there was a university, a small liberal arts college in the States, where there was a big uproar about showing a picture from Rashid al-Din's history that showed you know, the Archangel Gabriel appearing to Muhammad. You know, if you object to that sort of thing, there's a sense in which you have a harder time placing placing the events of your religion in time, space, and therefore in history. And that, you know, that connection, I think, should be somehow restored. I don't have any skin in the game here, but you know, an Islam with a proper historical pedigree and in touch with its roots and so forth, I think is not a bad thing. But the question of the caliphate is one that I don't know. I don't know how that's ever going to get resolved. And I don't know how you would, how should I put this? You know, if it really is a challenge that you simply must have to have a caliph, I don't know how you get beyond the calamity of 1258.
So I hope that this gives a little bit of understanding of how history has shaped, always been shaping in people's favor, and how, you know. So let's go a little bit ahead because we don't have too much time, but I'm going to try to, we we'll have to skip a few centuries, so I'm afraid, sorry for that. But okay. Let's begin with, you know, and that this is where I wanted to mainly focus on. That is when the First World War, of course, the rise of Hitler, and the Nazi Party has always used history and as well, and then how the Jews has always been this bad, you know, how just for the actions against the Jews, and they use history to show that all the Jews are these terrible people. And so let's talk about the Third Reich and how they use history to, you know, justify their cause, and the stuff in the back of it that they created around the First World War, that Jews were the cause for the stab in the back of it, and this is the cause of the Jewry that happened in Germany. And of course, that they are, the Jews are arguing to be the main focus when they talk about the Third Reich. We're going to talk about after this communists as well, but I want to begin with a little bit of the Third Reich and how they use history for their purposes and their justifications for their actions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the mind of Hitler and so forth, I think it was all, I don't think he had an especially keen grasp of history, and I don't think that he was especially intelligent. But the, you know, the hatred, you know, anti-Semitism had been a problem for a very long time. It has, unfortunately, very deep roots within Europe, and
It was
similar.
quite common in the 30s. It wasn't just Germany, and
I
though the
know, and
Nazi parties were quite extreme, but it was still present in UK, Norway, Sweden, and everywhere else in Europe. Most parts of Europe, it was antisemitism was a big
yes.
thing in the 30s.
And similar to things like the witch craze or other forms of hysteria, these times of great difficulty and sort of national or international crisis, they often conjure up these fantasies or sort of bogeymen to persecute and to blame for problems. And obviously this was this has been a problem throughout history. And what the Nazis did was play on that ancient hatred and flame it, I think, to a highly exaggerated extent. I don't think that there was much historic, I don't think there was any historical justification for it, but obviously they found some simply because it had been so deeply ingrained. And this is clearly one of the dark, evil sides of connecting yourself with the past. However, the Nazi past was entirely a fantasy. This idea that there was a kind of Teutonic Germanic virtue of sort of savage or semi-savage barbarous people overthrowing the Roman Empire and replacing it with a more vigorous race or whatever. I think that's really quite laughable, considering how deeply the Germanic peoples wanted to be Roman. Theodoric himself is quoted as saying, it's a poor Goth who doesn't want to be a Roman, and only a poor Roman would want to be a Goth. So I forget where that is, but somewhere he said it. Anyway, the fact of the matter is that I think it's important to see, number one, the Nazi interest in history as highly superficial and also, what's the word? Largely imaginary. And that I think it's more instructive to understand them as a kind of futuristic movement, the obsession with technology and speed and there's kind of perverse vision of hygiene and so forth. Like all of those things are modern things, and that Nazism, like other ideologies, flourished on deracinating people from history, from family and institutional life, from religion. Hitler notoriously hated Christianity also. The idea that there would be this sort of thousand-year Reich far into the future is not like that doesn't really have any kind of historical basis or grounding. And yet there is this paradox within the sort of Hitlerite Nazi obsession with sort of folksy Germanness and this idea that they are restoring some kind of older Germanic culture or something. They didn't do that at all. I mean, they wore lederhosen and things like that, but they're ultimately they're flying around in airplanes, and they've got all kinds of futuristic guns and machinery and big gigantic plans for a new capital that Hitler imagined as making ruins.
Germania.
Right. So, I think that if we fail to see them as if we fail to see the Nazis as a futuristic, deracinating movement, I think we don't understand them. And the abuse of history was to sort of transform it into a justification for this vision of the future, which is of course also very similar to what the Bolsheviks did. But
Which we'll talk about in a second.
I just want to emphasize one other point though, that this idea of savagery and like the rebarbarization of Europe, like that which was talked about in the 30s, this it isn't what I would call historical. It's almost like prehistorical. It's almost like a kind of atavistic memory of a pre-civilized time that the Nazis wished to recreate, and the consequences were simply horrific.
And another thing I want to talk about as well is that the Germans are the Third Reich and Hitler, the Soviets and the master race, the Aryans, and that they were superior to all others. But it is just this, and they have, of course, a historical basis for this as well. So let's talk a little bit about the Aryanism and where this came from, that the Germans were the supposedly master race of Europe.
Well, I think they tried to invent an historical basis for it. I don't think it was very successful or persuasive. I mean, that word Aryan, I mean, it originally described a linguistic group, but like this linguistic group, first of all, what do they all have in common? I mean, I can speak French, but that doesn't make me a French person. The fact that you talked a sort of Aryan or as we now say Indo-European, Indo-Iranian, Indo-Germanic, if you simply because you speak that language, it doesn't tell you anything about who the people were. This is largely a myth. I don't know who came up with it. I know that it was current in the air at the time. It comes from sort of Darwinian, a kind of crazed version of Darwinian theory, and mixed, mixed with the kind of Marxism too, the vision that you. Whereas Marx envisioned a kind of history of class struggle, racial scientists or Nazis saw a racial struggle. Both are preposterous, but they have a kind of there is a logic that's sort of common to both of them. The idea that, I mean, the idea that there was some kind of, well, I mean, I don't know how to say it. Like the idea is just simply nonsense. I mean, again, with the we're talking about, they idolized these barbarians who came down out of wherever they came from to overthrow the Roman Empire. Who was an Aryan there? I mean, didn't they admire the Romans too? I mean, I don't even know what we're supposed to make of that. But it also gets blended with a kind of that myth. The myth may have some truth to it, but the idea of the quote unquote Aryan invasion of India. or the migration into Iran. You know, these things kind of get mixed up into this narrative as you say, a master race that sort of comes down out of the north to rule over subject peoples, and you know that eventually they drift apart or get somehow diluted with intermarriage. I mean, it's just I don't really think there's a whole lot of evidence for that. I don't know how we would even know. But I'm not really sure how many people genuinely believed this kind of thing. I know that it was kind of something like this was floating around, but how seriously was it taken? I have some doubts about that, but it did get mixed up with a kind of weird mysticism and theosophy or Ariosophy of Himmler and company with sort of weird rituals and so forth. But the whole thing was a fake. They went around, Himmler's buddies went around faking artifacts or cave paintings, I think, just to show that there was like some ancient, ancient Aryan religion in Germany or something. It's just all a fantasy. But that's the danger, creating a kind of fake history. It doesn't actually give you roots or any kind of confidence in the past. It's all imaginary.
So let's move on next to how Marxists, which I think as well are masterful in justifying and playing propaganda in history. And I want to talk about what to begin with the 1848 revolution is the Marxists. And again, there are other examples as well where they saw the proletarian uprisings. And in 1848, Marxists use, they're very much a proletarian uprising against the bourgeoisie. So let's talk a little bit about how this worked and how they found out that, oh no, this is actually the proletarian rising up against the elite that they were tired of what the proletarian rule.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is very remote from my field, of course, but I see 1848 as much as you say originally. I mean, there was a hope that this would be the sort of formation of a kind of proletarian class consciousness, a sort of overthrow of bourgeois economics and norms and so forth. Of course, that didn't happen. But what did happen is that I think that the working class and the nobility actually discovered that they had far more in common than they originally thought, and that the sort of upper middle class movers and shakers of 1848 were actually not really on side with what the working classes genuinely felt. There's also a sense in which I think modern contemporary Roman Catholicism comes out of that revolution. That you have I'm going to get this all wrong. I won't remember the exact names, but you have, for instance, the Syllabus of Errors. It's after 1848, but the idea is that, you know, the papacy condemns both socialism, and extreme democratic sentiments, not to mention sort of over the reliance on absolutely pure reason and so forth. And it sort of slams the door on a sort of utopian political Christianity that could have potentially taken shape under the influence of socialism or Marxism. But yeah, I mean, I think that those religions, sorry, those revolutions were largely, you know, they mostly came to nothing. The cause of liberalism and socialism carried on, though. And that, I think that that sense of disappointment, there was a sense of disappointment that came after, or I should say after them, after those revolutions. And that I think to a certain extent that it's not never really gone away. That there's this sort of feeling within Western polities that, you know, nothing is quite right, and we're always going to be let down by political movements and so forth. But I can't help but separate. I can't help conceive at the same time that whereas the revolutions failed and left this kind of disappointment, that drive to sort of remake politics and society is still there, even though I think a lot of people still sense that they're kind of doomed to failure. But where would the historical, I mean, I see those as kind of a historical, sort of like revolutionary departures from the trend of European history. I guess that they're harking back to the French Revolution of 1789, I suppose, maybe the American one too, earlier. But I don't see much. I mean, were they justified with some kind of historical precedent? I don't know.
And speaking of justification, another thing I want to talk about as well in Marxist view and in Soviet Russia as well, is that the sort of, we have now we're going to talk a little bit about Ukraine. I want to talk a little bit about there, because Marxists and Soviet claims to Ukraine is that, you know, and Timothy Snyder pointed this out brilliantly in his, I don't know if you've seen the lecture on YouTube where he gives a modern history of Ukraine. It's brilliant. Absolutely go watch it, because it's just such a good overview, and read his books as well. They are so good. But he points out that, you know, the Soviets use this justification that Ukraine exists, but it doesn't exist, because it's but it's, it kind of exists. I'm probably quoting wrong, but it somehow it exists because it's going to be a part of Russia, and that's, you know, their justification for having Ukraine. It's ludicrous, of course, but that was their justification for taking over Ukraine.
Yes. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, taking it over at the same time as also insisting that it's already part of the same, I don't know what.
So they didn't really take over anything, you know?
Right. So, first, the Soviets. Ukraine did not want to be part of the Soviet Union. The collapse of the monarchy, the empire, was their first opportunity to leave, and they wanted to take it. And then there was a kind of back and forth, as I understand, there's kind of back and forth as to, you know, whether they would be somehow affiliated with this body centered in Moscow, and if so, how, and you know, if they were going to be a part of it, they need to be basically autonomous, or significantly more autonomous than I think some people would have preferred. I don't really understand what Putin is getting at. I think that he may be referring to that incident, or that series of events, when he refers to Lenin screwing up or something.
He blames Ukraine. Sorry, he blames Lenin for the creation of Ukraine. As far as I understand it,
yes,
both A historian about when he spoke with Stalin, he said that in the end of the episode that we Putin blames or blames Lenin for the creation of Ukraine.
Yeah, so I think it's that sort of back and forth, and giving them essentially giving Ukraine a rather autonomous and semi quasi-independent stature within the USSR originally. I think that's what he's talking about. Of course, later the Stalinist policy was basically to Russify Ukraine, which is connected with the famine, the Holodomor, and I think people are largely familiar with the rest of it. But that was always kind of heartland of the Soviet Union. That was where the breadbasket was, and the industrial heartland, the aviation industry, on and on. However, a big part of this problem is what we, and I think Snyder does this very well, or expresses it very well. The question is, what do we mean when we say Russia? Nobody called it, what we call Russia is this sort of kind of huge landmass, right? But there's only a part of it that would
Yeah,
actually be.
it's called the Russian Federation, right? There's lots of smaller autonomies of Russia that's not really Russia, but they are part of
Right.
Russia.
And then before that, you have Muscovy, and Muscovy starts calling itself Russia at some point, right? Except you also have lot most if not all of what is now Ukraine and Belarus, and I think even Polish Lithuanian Commonwealth and various other entities that are all calling themselves some form or version of Russia or Rus, because they all claim to be the direct sort of heir or descendant or sort of living continuation of the old Rus, whatever. And of course that's it's sort of not really clear to what extent that's a territorial term or kind of a political one. And it was of course founded by Norsemen, Vikings coming, and they founded all kinds of other settlements too. But and of course there were Slavs living there, and eventually they began speaking Slavic, and so on and so on and so on. This is the whole history that Putin gets completely wrong when it comes to the justification for the war. First of all, he doesn't give any credit to the Norsemen. I'm partly Icelandic. You're Norwegian, so we're getting the short end of the
Almost
stick.
related.
We can leave that aside. But there's also no, I mean, the sense that Kiev is the somehow the heartland of Russia, and yet Moscow is Russia, that doesn't make sense. And I see the whole operation as an example of just kind of I don't know, appropriating someone else's history. But I can't think of a good parallel. It would be something like Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, like, I don't know, conquering Great Britain, or sort of calling ourselves, first of all, we'd have to all call ourselves Great Britain, and then conquering Great Britain, or trying to conquer it, and saying that we're doing this because we're one people, and we're the real Great Britain. and your expert, the whole thing makes no sense to and it's,
And if I may as well, I always say that when Putin just says that Kiev has always belonged to Russia as well, blah, 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 something like that, he says. But as you know, we might point out that Russia was started in Kiev. The idea of Russia kind of came from Kiev. It's called Kiev Rus, not Rus Kiev. So
yeah.
If his claim is it's so ludicrous, because if what in it's my view, it should be Kiev that have historically played on Moscow, not the other way around, because Kiev was there first. So shouldn't then it then be that Kiev has the real right to rule Russia, not the other way around?
Right, but sure, but
I
the
mean,
question.
Of course, it's both are ludicrous, but you know, it's just Putin's way of thinking. It's kind of, in my view, it's should be the other way around, that Putin claims that Russia has the right to Kiev, also because of the, I'm sorry, just a second, I need to remember his name as well, because when, you know, the Cossack revolt in the 17th, under Peter the Great, Pugachev's, I think it was Pugachev, the Cossack rebellion under Peter the First, when they signed the contract that they would always belong to Russia, that Ukraine would always belong to Russia, that as well is what Putin uses as a justification, I think, to his invasion as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, to my way of thinking, I think that this contest is really quite stupid. I mean, the further back you go, and I'm not saying this in the sense to be, I don't want to seem somehow relativist or to I'm not saying that history doesn't matter. But this fight over who is the real Russia, I mean, I just think that that's really quite silly and strange. You know, who is the
yeah.
real, who is the real successor to Great Britain? I mean, who? There's a sense in which all English-speaking places are. But there still is a Great Britain, much diminished from its heyday. But there are still many successor states. There are many places where the king is still the king, and there's one big place that where the king isn't the king anymore, and they still speak English there, and they are still, in a sense, a successor to. Well, in a very real and obvious sense, they are a successor both to the culture, the language, the. Imperial heritage of Great Britain, and yet it doesn't cause the same kind of, I don't know, I'm not even sure what the word for it is. Like great, it's like a kind of insecurity, like a narcissistic insecurity in Moscow, and yet I would say that. In comparison with the parallel I just gave, all of these different places, Orthodox, you know, Slavic speaking places, they are all the successors of Rus. There's, you know, why would there be any question about that? And also, how does this justify a war? I don't really see. But obviously, you know, I know in history these things have happened before. These ideas do get invoked in the past. I just think that we in the West should be wary of recycling the Muscovite Russian view of things uncritically, which still happens in some textbooks or. Common, you know, I'm not sure how much people really think about this, but if they think about it at all, the Russian view, the Muscovite view, is certainly more widely known than the Ukrainian one. But you know, again, the historians should look into this, and they should develop their views on it and write and all the rest of it. But I still, I mean, this idea that the, you know, reappropriating or somehow reuniting the Rus people is like a legitimate justification for what is happening in Eastern Ukraine and Crimea. I don't accept that at all.
And let's talk about Crimea as well. Good thing you reminded me there, because, you know, Putin claims that as another thing that Crimea has always belonged to Russia historically, but that's really true, because before it was not until Catherine the Great, or Catherine the First, if you will, Catherine the Second, that if she invaded Crimea in the 1780s. So no, it's just been a few centuries that Crimea has belonged it was never part of Ukraine, it was never part of Russia until Catherine the Great invaded Crimea in the 17th, 18th, late 18th century. So
yeah,
it's ludicrous to think that it's always belonged to Russia when it hasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree with that. And of course, you know, Ukraine's borders from 1991 included Crimea, and they all voted to leave. Like that was what happened. So I mean, having said that, I don't think that the historical argument here is not a justification for what Russia did, but it's also not like they're going to pack up and go home if we prove that they're wrong.
That's certainly what this podcast almost no one listened to.
We will promote your podcast as widely as possible.
Maybe it will reach the Kremlin one day, who knows?
Yeah, right. So, where am I going with this? It has to be decided on the battlefield, as so many other things have been decided before. I mean, I think it's a little naive for people to say things like, "Oh, what you're doing is illegal." It's like, yeah, of course it's illegal, but I mean, like that didn't stop them. Or like, what you're doing has no historical justification. Well, that didn't stop them either. So hopefully it will be decided in Ukraine's favor on the battlefield, and hopefully soon. And
another thing that Putin does with the Crimea as well, I want to bring this up, is I do believe he blames Khrushchev as well again. The Crimea as a gift to Ukraine in the 50s. Yeah. I don't remember when, but he did give it away as a, I don't remember, an anniversary gift or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, he's referring to the referendum in the early 90s, right? 1991, where they voted to leave, and Crimea went with them because it was considered part of Ukraine. But I mean, what? I just think it's odd that Putin is actually hung up so much on former Soviet leaders. Every one of them is wrong. Lenin screwed up. Gorbachev, Gorbachev
was the greatest political disaster geopolitical disaster in the 20th century, as he says himself.
Yeah, I think it's important to wonder what does he mean by that? People say, well, he means that lots of Russian speakers and or ethnic Russians were left outside the borders of the Russian Federation.
And again, this reminds me, sorry to interrupt you, but I want to add that this reminds me as well about Hitler's takeover of Czechoslovakia, or was, I think he was, yeah. that there was a lot of
He
German
did
speakers
that.
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that there was a German speaker there, so that's why they had to go back. So kind of easy to draw parallels there when Hitler said that, oh, there's Germans living there and there's Germans living in Danzig. That's why we want Danzig, which was a free city at the time, and that's why we want Sudetenland, because there is. And that is also what Putin claims. Oh no, there's Russian families in the Ukraine that should be Russian, and there is people. Even though majority of the people in Crimea are Russian, they did not were interested in being a part of Russia. And I do believe they voted for this as well before the Crimean takeover. That majority did not seem to want to be a part of Russia. They had a referendum, I think, about this.
Yeah, and I don't trust the results
Yeah.
that the Russians I don't trust the results of the referendums that the Russians put on in more recent years. I don't think that the kind of like referendums at gunpoint or whatever the right metaphor is, but I think it's important. Okay, so you brought up Hitler, and I think that's an interesting parallel. I've heard it from others. I hope the present situation doesn't work out roughly the same way as the 1930s did. But I mean, what I'm not. I'm very, very, very far from being an expert on any of this stuff, but I wonder what an appropriate outcome of all this would really be. I've heard comparisons between contemporary Russia and late 18th, early 19th century France, which was a constant menace to everyone around them, constantly attacking and invading everybody, and
Not a great way to make friends.
right. But now France doesn't do that. Yep. And yet both France and Russia have, I think, a very strong sense of self image and mission and destiny in the world. Russia could well be different at some
I mean,
point in.
there is an election this year in Russia, but I think fairly certain that we are fairly sure of the outcome, what the outcome will be, but we wait and see. We wait and see. Who knows? Maybe I'm wrong, but we wait and see for the election results.
Well, I'm a little bit concerned about that for two reasons. Number one, it just seems like between now and March, or whenever the election is in March, it seems like Putin would be looking for some kind of signal victory in Ukraine, and that could create a kind of desperation, or potentially it could. Potentially, he could eventually have nothing to bring to the table, so to speak, and battle lines could remain frozen or something, and then things don't quite work out. The grumbling gets worse, and eventually Putin is taken out, and then there's some kind of civil war again. I don't know. It just seems like a very potentially volatile.
I mean, they did try to have Belarus as well. They did try to have elections, and it went badly in Lukashenko's favor. But he's still in power, so I imagine even if Putin were to lose, he will still remain and ignore the election result as Lukashenko did, because it seems most likely, even though we are fairly certain that the result will point in Putin's favor, he will still ignore the result and still stay in the Kremlin. This is a man that don't think will voluntarily leave the throne, even if with an election result. He'll be shot out of the throne quite literally to get out, I think. Till
Well,
death do us part.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it is certainly he doesn't need an election. This seems to be mainly a kind of, I don't know what even, I don't know what you would call it. It's like a sham election to create the appearance of legitimacy. I don't really know what that's all about or what it's for. And of course, this year we have an American election, and we have, I think there's a European Union election. Lots of elections, lots of opportunities for instability, for more foreign meddling, and it's gonna be a rough year. But who knows what who knows how things may eventually shake down. I do think, though, that a lot of this trouble is motivated mostly by insecurity of borders, demographic collapse, the lack of any kind of what's the word? Well-developed sort of succession plan as to, where the Putinist regime or vision or whatever you want to call it will go after he leaves. Same thing in Iran, same thing in China.
Pakistan, to mention another, or Afghanistan.
Yeah. And I don't know, Putin doesn't look well to me. I'm not sure I agree. First of all, I don't really agree that he has secretly died and he's been replaced by some, although I've read a lot about that. I don't know how ill or what. He doesn't look healthy. By Russian standards, he's an old man, may die soon.
The way I look at this is to use a metaphor. As you know, after Stalin's death, there was a question of either Beria or Khrushchev taking over the Soviet Union. And luckily, we ended up with Khrushchev. But the way I see it, we could either get a Khrushchev type or someone that lunatic like Beria, probably the trial that's even worse. It's even worse than Stalin, or will be even worse than Putin. So, in the way I look at it, we will either get a Khrushchev or a Beria succeeding Putin. But it's
Well,
my understanding that Putin doesn't really have a successive plan at the present moment.
yeah, I mean, I don't think so either. I mean, I don't know, but I don't think anyone is all very mysterious. I don't think he does. I don't think that again, I'm not sure what the right metaphor is, but the Russian elite is not, it's not like the Soviet Union, where there was a great deal of at least genuine or possibly feigned ideological strength, as well as a high standard of education. The Soviets were very much for educating engineers and very, very keen on high
Scientists.
scientists, high competence, that sort of thing. And there were a lot of them. That isn't the case anymore. The Russian elite is very small. The oligarchs all store their wealth abroad. There's been a spectacular brain drain. So I just see that circle of elites getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And that doesn't bode well for the future of Russia. Demographically, Moscow and St. Petersburg are basically doomed unless they start having more kids, which obviously Putin is very keen on. There was some stupid announcement recently about praising and rewarding mothers who had tons of kids. I don't think that's going to go anywhere, no matter how much they talk about it. The Soviet and Russian birth rates have collapsed repeatedly, and haven't really recovered, and you know, I view a lot of what we're seeing as symptoms of this decline. So sometimes I'm tempted to think that it's not really a question of, well, Russia's going to, is Russia going to decline after this? It's more like, what does the present situation tell us about the current state of decline? If you see the difference. And I don't know enough to say, but I don't see evidence of like a thriving, vigorous culture and I think there's a phone ringing somewhere in the background.
I think we're gonna finish round up there, and I hopefully you have a decent understanding how people always have shaped history to their image. And before you go, of course, where can people find you on Twitter or X, whatever they call it these days? And where can people buy your book? Well, let's not call your X right now, maybe, but that's where can people find your book, or you have anything else you want to promote? And of course, always a pleasure to have you back, and thank you for coming. So before you go, yeah, you can promote, or if you have wanted to put any links in the description, you can do that. So where can people find your social media, or if they have any questions further of the episode, and also check out the other episodes we did on how the past can renew our presence.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So thank you so much for coming. This has been With That H12. We are available on Twitter/X under With That H12. And we are also on Threads now under With That H12. We are available on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If we are on Spotify, rate us 5 stars. If you're on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. My name is Alan, and I will see you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.